Last week, we had finished up the section talking about how the doctrine of faith only clearly contradicts the Bible, spending a lot of time in James chapter 2, how James very clearly made that point. In fact, the only time we see faith only or faith alone mentioned in the New Testament is in the negative, because he says, you see that man is saved by faith only. And of course, finishing up there by bringing up the fact that many of the rulers during Jesus' time in his earthly ministry, that they believed. These wealthy, influential people, they believed in him, but they didn't, do anything. They didn't act on it. They sure didn't say that they believed in him because they were afraid of the rulers. They were afraid of the Pharisees. They didn't want to be cast out of the synagogue. So there were a lot of people who believed in him, but when push came to shove, they denied him rather than confessing him, what Jesus talks about there in Matthew chapter 10. So these ones, they believe, but of course, they're not saved. And that kind of gets into what we're looking at tonight. And I can't help but bring up, I thought about this last week, but I never mentioned it. I heard a great example one time on this whole subject of faith and faith only and all of that. And some of this may be semantics and it may be splitting hairs. The way the English language works, we have words that overlap and more or less mean the same thing, and then we draw these lines. But I heard someone say one time is that you can believe, you can have a belief that this man, this circus performer, this acrobat, can push a wheelbarrow across a tightrope, across a high wire. But it takes faith to get in the wheelbarrow, making a distinction there between belief and faith, and that being a living, active faith. And of course, that's what we're looking at here. So anything else before we get into this section talking about that we are saved by faith when faith obeys? All right. So the first example that is given has to do with the walls of Jericho. Now, here we're looking at Hebrews chapter 11 and in verse 30, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. And this is also going back to Joshua chapter 6. So is there any doubt that the people at the time had faith? No, they clearly believed. The people of Joshua's day were not perfect. They had their faults like anyone else does, but they were faithful. They were keeping the law. It had been drilled into them because the previous generation had died in the wilderness. They weren't allowed to go into the land. These people went into the land. They were given the land of promise. They saw the Jordan River parted. They're seeing all of these things, the works of God. And now they come into the land and they're told that they can take Jericho, and they're told how to do it. So what was the pattern that God gave them? If you go back to Joshua 6, what were they supposed to do? March around it. Yeah. Once a day for 6 days, and then 7 times around on the 7th day. On the last day, if I remember correctly, no one was to say anything until they had marched around the seventh time, then they make this great shout. This it was, it's like putting together a piece of furniture. If you don't follow the instructions, it's not going to be what you want it to be. What's that? Yeah, they blew trumpets. Yeah, great shout, blowing the trumpets, this big thing. So that's what we're seeing here. But so they had faith in God, but they also followed his instructions. They followed the conditions. They met those things. And, of course, to have done what it says here, to have done other than what God had specified would have been positive proof of a lack of faith. Because, yeah, if they're listening to God and he tells them to go march to Jericho, and they do, but only, once every other day or something, well, you're not listening. You're only partially listening. This was a test. This was a test of their faith. They believed, and the walls fell by faith. But you notice the wording there in Hebrews chapter 11. And we're going to be looking at this chapter again. This is a great chapter of faith, where it defines faith, talking about all this. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. No doubt that God had the power to do it. If God wanted to, he could just do it right away. And no doubt that the people had faith. Are you saying it took them 7 days to build up, a certain level of faith. Well, no, that's not what it's saying at all. It's just after being encircled for the 7 days, you know, when they had finished doing what God told them to do, that's when the walls fell. So it was by faith. And if you want to disagree on that, then you're not disagreeing with me, you're disagreeing with the book of Hebrews, because that's what it says. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell, but they fell at this point when it was faithful obedience. All right, so the next example being brought up is here in Hebrews chapter 11, back in verse 7. Who's mentioned there?
Noah.
All right, by faith. Any doubt that Noah had faith? Well, no, of course not. Because he lived at a time where it said all the thoughts of people were evil continually. He's the one person, it seems like, that God had favor on that was actually doing what was right. So there's no doubt that Noah was a faithful man. The fact that God would speak to him directly and choose him. So he's warned by God there in verse 7 concerning events as yet unseen. And how does it describe him? What kind of emotion, what kind of attitude there in Hebrews 11 and verse 7? He moved with fear. The English Standard says, in reverent fear, constructed an ark for the saving of his household. So, in holy fear, yeah. So, he has fear. Now, there's fear there, because a lot of times we think of faith being the opposite of fear. If you're afraid, well, then that fills you with doubt, and doubt is the opposite of faith. But we're not talking about, you know, shaking in his boots, that type of thing. This holy fear. You know, he had fear of God. That was his faith. So by faith, he's being warned by God of what's to come. He builds this ark. And of course, yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah. There's an awful lot of people today who have a faith, they have a belief, but you see the way they not only live their lives and as such treat God, but the way they talk about God, there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of reverence or fear. And it's really sad the way people have made him into this, you know, he's your buddy, he's this, you know. No, he's our holy, righteous Father in heaven. There's to be a, you know, that kind of yes sir. There's to be some respect there. Yeah.
So I was afraid to go to hell. You know, that type of thing. That's the type of fear that I once had looking at God. Mm-hmm. You know, if I didn't do right, I'd say, should be in hell. Not because he's my father and I should respect, you know, what he's told me to do.
Well, and it's not to say that there isn't any place for that type of fear, because we can use Noah's, isn't it a scary thought that he's going to flood and destroy the world? Yeah, that's scary. And so based on that fear, you build the ark. But like you're saying, that's not the same fear that we're supposed to, when we talk about fearing God. It's that reverence. It's holding him in that manner of respect. But the point that they're making here, in this idea of, by faith, Noah and his household being saved, if he had that attitude of faith only, why build an ark? Why, you know, I believe in God, I trust in God, but he built the ark. And again, we can compare this to the example of the people of Joshua's time. How did he build the ark? Well, construction, but how? Oh, by the instructions, by faith? Yeah, again, God gave clear instructions. This many cubits long, this many cubits wide. You're supposed to do this, you're supposed to do it. Made out of gopher wood. I've always heard people, you know, bring up the example. We have, you know, some other type of wood, you know, ash or maple. You know, it floats, right? It's buoyant. You get into the physics, all that stuff. Well, if he had built the ark out of that, would it have floated? Well, we don't know, but it wouldn't have been what God instructed, so it wouldn't have done the job of saving him. I'm not saying it would have defied physics and refused to float, but it wouldn't have happened the way it was supposed to. But he followed the instructions to the letter. He made it from the right wood, pitched inside and out, did exactly what God told him to do. And so he had faith, but it was this living, active faith. He was saved by faith, but when faith obeyed. You know, couldn't God have just put him in a bubble and had him, you know, hover over the waters and all that? Sure, God could have. God could have given them gills and they could have, whatever. But God chose this way. And again, just like with Jared, it was a test. He knew Noah believed in him. He knew Noah was found to be a righteous man. So, you know, how much do you believe? Do you believe in me when I say that I'm going to flood the earth? They'd never seen rain at that point. That's what it means there in Hebrews when it says events as yet unseen. They had no idea what that was. But did he trust in God enough to know that God knew what he was talking about and to, you know, hop to it when God gave him the instructions? Yes. He did exactly what God told him to do. Anything else on Noah?
How long did it take to build the ark?
Somewhere around 100 years. Yeah. Yeah, stop and... No, no, yeah. And you think after 100 years, you work on a job, you want to, you know, go to another job. Can't we just be done with this already? That's when you're tempted to cut corners, is when you've been on a while. Well, he worked at it for, give or take, 100 years. But he worked on it until it was done. So, all right, so the next example we have is back in Numbers chapter 21. So in Numbers chapter 21, what was the situation going on with the people of Israel? There was a problem, not surprising, given the people and everything we've seen of them. But what did they do? Again. It wasn't an idol. It became one later on. So in Numbers chapter 21 and in verse 5, well, actually, it's the tail end of verse 4, it says the people became impatient on the way. In verse 5, the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and we loathe this worthless food. I mean, we could probably spend half the evening just getting into what they're saying here and just how ungrateful and horrible it is. But so, first of all, why have you brought us up out of Egypt? Don't you remember you were slaves in Egypt and you were crying out for you know, God to deliver you, and how you're saying you wish he hadn't? So first of all, there's that. Secondly, they're saying that God did this only to let them die in the wilderness. They don't have any trust that God's going to take care of them when he's shown time after time that he will. There's no food, no water, and we loathe this worthless food. When they say worthless food, what are they talking about?
Same thing, different day.
Yeah, same thing, different day. The quail, the stuff God provided for them. You know, there's no such thing as a free lunch, but they literally had food just dropped on them. That was the manna. They didn't have to work for it. They had to go out and gather it, but it was there. In part, it was also because he knew they would need to eat along the way as they're going up to the promised land. But yeah, there's that too. So God gives them this miraculous food. Just appears out of nowhere. 6 days out of the week, they weren't to go gather it on the Sabbath. They're gathered twice as much on Friday. Miraculous food. He's not doing this for anyone else. It's very clearly a special gift given just to them. We loathe it. It's worthless food. I mean, you know, it's you're given this wonderful gift, and then just to react that way. And we know how we would feel if we saw our children doing that, when someone is kind enough to do something for them. So what God does is he sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people so that many people died. Now, once the punishment comes, the people are then pretty quick to figure out, oh, this is because we've sinned. They realize what they had done. So they go to Moses and they ask him, pray to the Lord that he may take away the serpents for us. So that's what they asked for. Did God take away the serpents? No. To me, that's one of the funny things. They didn't get exactly what they asked for. God didn't take away the serpents. What he did was he told Moses to make a fiery serpent made out of bronze and put it on a pole, and anyone who, if they ever get bitten, if they look on that, then they won't die. So this is what God has come up with. This is his solution. It's not exactly what they wanted. It's not what they had in mind. But he's telling them, you don't have to die. You know, you're seeing your neighbors, your friends, you know, left and right being killed by these snakes, by these venomous serpents. You don't have to. If you get bitten, which it wasn't a guarantee, it's just a lot of people were, but if you get bitten, you look on this and you'll live. Okay? Is there faith required in that?
Yeah. Remember, they heard if they had faith enough to look on the serpent, then that would take care of the problem.
Yeah. You'd have to have faith. You know, this isn't a doctor coming with some kind of antidote or antitoxin or anything. This is not a standard medical practice. Just look on this and you'll be fine. So it does require faith to do this. So there is faith there, but when would they be saved? When they obeyed, when they looked on it. It's not just, well, God's given us this serpent, so we're okay. No, if you get bitten, you have to go and look at it. It's not enough to know that it's there and to know that your cousin, that he got bitten, he looked at it and he's okay. No, you have to go and do it. It's not enough for you to have faith. You have to act upon that faith. So it's not faith only. It's faith, now that I have this faith, that I do believe that it has the power to save me, that I'm going to go by faith, look upon the serpent, and be saved. And if you turn over to the next page, or page 40, in that top paragraph as we continue this, it makes the point that, you know, this is salvation by faith. So when we preach from the scriptures, what it says regarding salvation, regarding baptism, you know, baptism is not, baptism is not water salvation, it's salvation by faith. You know, there's no controversy here. It's not this or that. It is by faith, but this is just the mode, this is the method that God chose. It's the condition that he set. And that last point is great. The question is, when is one saved by faith? Because we know faith saves. It's when faith complies with the conditions. All right. Anything else on this notion that it has to be a living, active faith? Yes, faith saves, but only when it's obeyed, only when it's living and active. All right. So this last section here makes is believe. Is they'll go to passages that reference this. You know, believe in the Lord, you and all your house, and you'll be saved. There's so many passages that talk about faith saving. And do we disagree with any of those passages? Well, no, of course not. It's the Bible. It's the inspired word of God. It is true. You know, he knows what he's talking about. Those passages aren't wrong. But to make the case that they're making for faith only and only citing them is ignoring so many other passages, and we're not just getting nitpicky about baptism either. The last section here making the point that justification, being made right in the sight of God, is ascribed to several agents. I saw a chart, an infographic once that broke this down, and I wish I had saved it or whatever, because I'm not sure where it is now. I can't find it, but it was this idea of, you know, what does the Bible say saves? And it's a long, long list going through all these different verses. So, you know, Romans chapter 3 says we're justified freely by his grace. So by faith, by grace, and by him that is Christ, everyone that believeth is justified. And so Acts chapter 13, so what saves? Christ. And then we're justified by his blood there in Romans chapter 5. Justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, in his name. And of course, Romans 5, justified by faith. And then where we already read over in James chapter 2, by works a man is justified. Yet so many people just want to say faith only, that all you have to do is believe. Well, as long as you believe, then everything will be okay. Well, what about the blood of Christ? What about his name, his authority? What about works? What about all these other things? And there's more than what we're seeing here. What about all these other verses that talk about this that saves us? You only have two options. You either believe that, well, you can pick and choose, so this person can be justified by the blood of Christ, and I'm going to be justified by my faith, that it's one or the other, and you can just take your pick, or you have to believe that it's all of them working together. And that's the only solution that really makes sense. Because if you talk to someone about faith, they say, well, you don't need the blood of Christ. Oh, yeah, sure you do. So, you know, they say faith only, but when it really gets down to it, they admit there are other things involved in the salvation process, but they just want to zero in on the notion of faith. You have to have the complete picture. You have to have every piece here. And, of course, the example that's being made here is the idea of this man who is drowning. And so this other man is moved by grace and goodwill. He sends his son. You know, they throw him a rope. So you have here, you know, the motive in salvation. You have this agent to accomplish it. You have all of these different parts working together to save this man. And it's the same thing for us. It's the same way the gospel works. God has given us everything we need. And we do have to believe. Faith is very clearly involved. It's a part of the plan of salvation, but it is not the entire thing. It has to be not just any old type of faith, because as we see from the scriptures, you can have all kinds of different faith. You can have little faith, as we talked about in our class this morning. You can have weak faith, immature faith, strong faith. You know, not all faith is the same. So depending on how your faith is, if you are acting upon it, that's going to make the big difference. All right, anything else as we finish up lesson 15? All right, so we want to get into lesson 16 here. Again, continuing this thought, the main thought there being salvation, man being saved. And as we're making this point, we have to understand the overall point that's being made here is that man is in need of saving. Which is getting over to Romans chapter 3, that all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, that we are in sin, and as such we are separated from God, and we have the wages of sin, we have death coming to us, that we stand guilty of that, and we deserve the punishment that comes associated with it. So we need to be saved. We have a very clear problem. So man needs saving, and man can be saved. God didn't just say, sorry about your luck. No, he made it possible. He has offered a way to have those sins forgiven. So once you understand that we need salvation and that we can have salvation, it's not this unattainable, you know, pipe dream, is that how we accomplish that, how we can get that. We just spent all this time talking about the fact that it's not by faith only. Now we want to spend some time talking about the fact that we are saved by the blood of Christ. So this kind of gets into the way God thinks and the way God operates, which may be, you know, a lot to take in sometimes, because it's hard for us to wrap our minds around someone being all powerful, all, you know, all seeing, that he's everywhere. And, you know, we would think, well, why wouldn't he just do it this way, or why wouldn't he do it that way? And that's kind of getting into the mind of God, which is beyond you or I. So why he chose this versus why he you know, didn't choose that, I don't know. And we may never know. We get certain clues and certain hints why he did things the way he did, and it makes sense. But, you know, this is what we see. So what God set up when he created the world, when he created everything, we see there's always been efficacy and procuring power in blood. Deuteronomy chapter 12, verse 23, as they're reiterating this point, that they're not to eat animals that have the blood in them, for the blood is the life. In each dispensation, every dispensation of time, God has demanded a sacrifice of a bloody nature. And while we think that's, you know, weird or gross or whatever, the point it's making is that there is atoning power of blood. The first time this comes up is very early on in Genesis chapter 4. Now, it's not the first sin to ever be committed, and I'm assuming it's not the second or third either. So sin has already entered the world. There's already been sin and temptation, but when Genesis chapter 4, and we see the account of Cain and Abel, this is the first time that blood is brought forth. We're told that Abel brings forth of the firstlings of his flock a sacrifice to the Lord, and that sacrifice was accepted. Cain's sacrifice was what? Yeah, fruits, vegetables, it was his crops. You know, that's what he did. He was a farmer. Now, are we to assume that Cain just gave whatever crops were lying around, bruised, old? No. I mean, you certainly can't read that from the text back in Genesis chapter 4. And from what we understand of Cain and Abel, they believed in God. They spoke directly to God. They must have had some kind of faith and reverence to him. So no, just as much as we read that Abel gave of the firstlings of his flock, you know, we're to understand that Cain gave the fruit of the ground. You know, he would have given some of the best of what he had. And not only did he give of the best of what he had, but he knew which would be the best. He's a farmer. You know, this is, you know, you work with what you know, with what you're good at. This is what he was good at. But even with all that, was it accepted? No. Why not? It didn't satisfy the man. It wasn't what God wanted, all right? It wasn't what God wanted. And of course, Cain doesn't like that his sacrifice is not accepted. Rather than asking, you know, what can I do to correct this, to fix this, rather than admit that he, you know, maybe didn't get things right, he more or less blames God. Why isn't it good enough for him? He should have accepted me, that type of thing, which leads to the conflict with Abel. But the point that's being made here is this first bloody sacrifice was a type of the blood of Christ shed for the sins of the world. So it kind of set the tone. What's the sacrifice that God would accept? It's that type of sacrifice. And of course, we know all the sacrifices involved, and we're going to get there with the law of Moses and everything that the Jews as a nation did. But before you get there, between Abel and Moses in that long age of the patriarchs, we see time after time of individuals setting up altars and offering sacrifice to God. Well, when they did that, what did they offer? Animal and blood sacrifice, because they knew that's what would be pleasing to God. Like we said, it might sound weird or gross to us. Why would it have to be that? Couldn't have God made it of anything else that he wanted to? Sure, he could have, but he made it this for a reason, and that reason, as we said, is to, you know, have it be a foreshadowing, that it's a type, you know, looking forward to the blood of Christ. Now, Abraham understood the importance of offering sacrifices to God. He did it on a regular basis. Abraham was a man of deep faith. It's shown in his life. God tells him to go to this land he's never been to. He packs up and goes. God tells him that he's going to have a son. He's going to have a son. You know, time after time, Abraham has shown his faith, so he knows that God requires these sacrifices. But then he's commanded to offer Isaac. Has God ever commanded a human sacrifice before? No. So that might seem strange to Abraham, especially considering who the sacrifice was supposed to be. You know, God, didn't you tell me that I would have all of these descendants, that I would have, you know, children, grandchildren, all of this, and it would come through Isaac? How can that happen if he's dead? But we still don't see any hesitation from Abraham. He's commanded to offer Isaac, but before he could, we're told the angel stops him, stays his hand. And what did, before they got up on the mountain, what was it that Abraham said when Isaac pointed out that they didn't have anything to offer? Yeah, God will provide. The Lord will provide, and he did. And he stopped Abraham. There was a ram there. They kill the ram. They offer blood sacrifice. Now, the big one Like I said, we kind of skipped ahead and talked about it already, but the big one comes in the Law of Moses. Now, in the Law of Moses, they had sacrifices for just about everything. They had the guilt offering, the sin offering, but of course, the big one would be the Passover. And it has to do with the literal Passover. Why did they kill the Passover lamb? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they kill it, they take the blood, they put it on the door. When the angel would see the blood, he would pass over. It was to save them. You know? Right, they ate it, but they used its blood for that. Yeah. It was a token of safety and security. God had promised. And so, getting back to what we were talking about, just a few minutes ago, the children of Israel obeyed, and there was not a single death among them. They did this by faith, but it was a faithful obedience. So no one of Israel died because they offered the sacrifice, they took the lamb, they took the blood, they did this. It's again showing blood is important. It's the method that God has chosen to pay the price, to be that atonement. So this is what we're seeing here. And we reference over in 2 Thessalonians chapter 1 right here. It says, we have a warning. Another day will come in which the messenger of destruction will go forth in flaming fire, rendering vengeance to them that know not God and to them that obey not the gospel of our Lord Jesus. So while it doesn't specify the Passover per se, the idea there is that there's this coming destruction, and it will be for everyone except for those who would believe and obey. So just as the Israelites were spared by the blood of lambs, so those cleansed by the blood of Christ will be spared at the last day. Blood is the price. It's the cost that has been set. It's been determined by God. We think, why did Jesus have to come? Why did he have to die? Why go through all this? Because that was the way God set it up. Now we can question, why did God have to set it up that way in the first place? I don't know. That's what God decided to do. It's up to him. He can make it whatever he wants, and that's what he chose. But since he chose it, we have all of the types, all the foreshadowings, ultimately leading to Christ. Diana?
Mm-hmm.
It was a particular day. So they did it that time for the reason of having the angel pass over them, but he said you would do it every year. He told them to set it up as a yearly remembrance, that they would go through this to remember what happened that day.
It wasn't a special day before that.
No. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't a special day before that. In fact, they didn't even have a set calendar before that.
They did a lot of different, festivals, and feasts, and remembrances, and done this thing and that thing. I thought maybe this would happen to be one of those days, and this was added to it.
Oh, no, this was like the first one, because you go back to there in Exodus where this whole thing's being established, he's saying that this month will be the first month for you. So that was like the creation of the Jewish calendar. And that month, Nisan, which the Passover falls on the 14th of it, I believe. So it was the 14th of Nisan. But anyway, he said, this will be the first month for you. So they didn't even have a set calendar to plan stuff until then. So it was made, and then Passover is instituted, and then everything else, like you're saying, got added later when they're given the law over at Sinai. Yeah. So this is, like you said, Passover is further proof of the importance of blood. It's the currency that God had made. It's the cost for atonement. But it's not just the cost of atonement. It's not just the thing that pays the price. Our next point here brings out the fact that the sealing of the covenants with blood also bears testimony to the importance of blood in God's plan. So we've talked about this before, but just quickly, you know, summing it up, what's a covenant?
An agreement.
What kind of agreement?
A promise.
Yeah, it's not casual. It's not, well, I'll try to make it kind of thing. It's I'm going to be here. It's a promise. It's very similar to a contract, but it's not as dry as a contract. This isn't a business-like arrangement. It's deeply, you know, personal as a covenant. So it's a promise, it's a contract, it's a very serious thing that you go through, but it's not some business exchange. So when they would make a covenant, and this is what we see here, the children of Israel expressed a desire to keep the ordinances that Moses received from God. They made offerings, burnt offerings, peace offerings, went up to God, and the blood of these animals was used to seal the covenant. You know, they go through this ceremony there in Exodus chapter 24. And the Hebrews writer talks about it there in chapter 9. They use this blood to signify sealing of the covenant. What would we compare that to? If a covenant is you know, an agreement, an arrangement, a contract, a promise, that type of thing, what would sealing that do? Or what would it be like?
Signing.
Yeah, it's final, signing it, yeah. It's like when people, you know, will shake on it. It's the thing that sets it in stone. So they've said they're going to follow after God. Well, do you really mean it? You know, you seal the covenant. So it's not just the notion that blood is the method that would atone, but it's also sealing this covenant. It's to show that they were serious about it, that they meant it, that they're going to follow through, and they go through all of that. So it's the thing that God had set up from a long time ago of how they were to make atonement. But it also sealed the covenant. And then, in addition to that, our next point there, talking about the tabernacle and all the vessels that they made according to God's instruction, they were sanctified and sealed by the blood of animals. So after they were made, you have these amazing things. You had the best craftsmen in all of Israel. Their wood overlaid with pure gold. They'd be beautiful and weigh a ton. And, you know, all things you can say about them. But they had to sprinkle them with blood to sanctify them. So blood sealed the covenant, and it also sanctified. And again, quickly sum up, what does it mean to be sanctified? Set apart for a purpose, to be special. This isn't anything ordinary. And again, you know, you take one look at them, these solid, you know, pure gold overlaid things, they would look pretty special, but it's not enough that you would see them and think that you have to know that they're sanctified, that they're made special, made holy, and they were made that way according to this blood from what God had instructed them. All right, but all that being said, you get down to our next point there, number 6. In the Jewish system, under the law of Moses, you had all of these animal sacrifices all the time, I mean, daily, yearly, all these different things, but what could they not do? They couldn't remove sin. Now, there is no removal of sins under the old law. The Hebrews writer talks about this there in chapter 10, that it was a shadow of the good things to come. And it mentions these sacrifices were year after year. They're offered continually. But it didn't offer forgiveness, because then they would cease to be offered. Because once sin's gone, you don't have to worry about it. So they would have no more consciousness of sins. But in those sacrifices, there is a remembrance made of sins year by year. It's impossible. So why, the question is kind of raised, why go through all of this? In our next point there, you know, what was the purpose of such? If it's not going to take away sins, why go through all these sacrifices year after year? Besides the obvious, because God told them to. Okay, to be in good favor with God.
Yeah, hold it forward, kind of take it for the time being.
Yeah, it was kind of, you know, band-aid, a stopgap measure. It didn't forgive the sins, but every year they had that day of atonement. It atoned for them for that year. And it rolled the sins forward. It was a remembrance of their sins. Their sins are still there. But again, well, what's the point of that? What's the point in rolling these sins forward? A tutor. Teaching them what?
What sin?
What sin is. Yeah. And pointing towards something, right? Yeah. The purpose of all, you know, why go through all this? Why have this yearly day of atonement if it's not going to forgive? Because it's showing you, you know, all of this sin is still there. It's atoned for the time, for this year. But come next year, you're going to have to make another sacrifice. It's pointing towards something better. Something that would come, that would eventually take away those sins. So why remember these sins? So that you are looking for something better. So that you're looking for the coming Christ, for the Messiah. Is there anything else through all these points here? All right, I know we're moving a little quickly, but trying to cover a lot of ground here. So in Hebrews chapters 9 and 10, we've already been discussing some of these passages here, but in those two chapters in particular is where we see a clear and forceful analogy with reference to the blood of the animals and the blood of Christ. So there's a lot of similarities. You know, that's why we're saying it's an analogy here. The first covenant is dedicated by blood, and the new covenant is dedicated and sealed by blood. So you know, they both involve blood. So there's that in common. But under the old covenant, under the old law, the Israelites had the weight of sin moved forward just for a year. They had that atonement. But we have actual forgiveness. All right. The next point that's being made has to do with the high priest. Where did the high priest go on the Day of Atonement? Yeah, into the Holy of Holies. He went through the curtain, and that's where the ark was. That's where God, you know, rested above the mercy seat. And on that day, he made atonement first for himself, and then for all the people. But how does this compare with Christ? Okay, his was once for all, not yearly. What else was different about him? Okay, yeah, he was giving of himself, so it's different in that regard. The high priest under the old law first had to offer for himself, right? Jesus didn't have to. Because he was pure, he was sinless. So he didn't have to make an offering for himself before he could go do for the people. There wasn't this intermediary there. He was perfect. So he had none, and that's why he could offer his own blood. And then this gets into the nature of the sacrifice itself. We're talking about differences and similarities in the high priest. But in the sacrifice, all of those animals they offered, all the lambs, all the bulls, all these things over and over and over again, did the animals have a say in that? No. No offense to those animals, from what we understand, they were the best. They were the first fruits. That's what they offered to God. So as far as bulls and lambs and goats and all that, they were the best you could hope for. But they didn't volunteer for that. They didn't want to be sacrificed. They had no part in it. It's not a willing sacrifice. But with Christ, it is. And it's not just to the extent that he was willing to come to this earth and that he was willing to go to the cross. It's that he was willing to put up with all of it. Because if he could have stopped it at any time. And that's the thing. These animals, you know, they're just animals. They don't know any better. So they're being led along. But once the blade would start getting, you know, then they'd try to struggle, right? Once they're in it, even if they never tried to stop it or get away before, then they would try to stop it. Well, Jesus was hanging on that cross for how many hours, Jim? I think. At least
six.
Six, yeah, I was thinking at least four or five. Around 6 hours. 6 hours is a long time to reconsider and change your mind on something. from 9 to 3. Yeah, yeah, so 6 hours. Thank you. So he's a willing sacrifice. Didn't just start out as a willing sacrifice and then, you know, go back on it later. He went through. He endured the cross. What? Oh, right. Well, they were as perfect as they could be. Physically, they were perfect, yeah. But they couldn't be perfect exactly like him because it wasn't the perfect sacrifice. But of course, you get to the top of the next page. The conclusion is, apart from shedding of blood, this is what we see over in Hebrews 9. Without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sins. It just can't happen. Under the old law, the blood of those animals didn't forgive their sins. It rolled them forward, but rolled them forward pointing to something that would. And something that would was being foreshadowed by them. So even then, they understood for to have these sins forgiven, there would have to be shedding of blood. That's what it takes to have sins forgiven. So anything else before we move on to the next main section here? Jim? Yeah.
And so it's not any one, it's all of them.
The sum.
The sum of them.
Yeah. For those of you who couldn't hear, Jim was bringing up Psalm 119 and 160, where it says, the sum of your word is truth. So all of it being added up together, every one of your righteous rules endures forever. Now getting back to what we were talking about, what saves, well, it's this and this and this. It's not this or that, it's everything all together. And of course, the central figure in this would be the blood of Christ. That's one of the things that's listed that justifies us. Now, it's not the blood of Christ alone, because if that were the case, well, then you don't even have to believe. You know, he went to the cross, he already did, his blood shed, it's done, it's taken care of. But that's not the case, because we're told we're given this message of salvation. Well, what message? It's salvation. It's already done by the blood of Christ. It is by his blood, but there's also faith. There's all these different things that go into it. All right. So, yeah, we're out of time. All right. So, Lord willing, we'll pick up with this next week, talking about Christ's blood being shed for human redemption and how, and then going on from that, how we're cleansed by his blood. But thank you so much.